This is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. D.C. versus Heller and McDonald versus Chicago are two U.S. Supreme Court decisions receiving a lot of re-examination these days as the country debates gun rights and gun control. Both cases dealt with our Constitution's Second Amendment and its stated right to bear arms. McDonald is the most recent ruling from 2010. In it, the High Court struck down Chicago laws restricting handguns, but the justices also said their decision did not, in their words, imperil every law regulating firearms. The Heller case was decided 2 years earlier in 2008, having to do with a challenge to Washington, D.C.'s handgun ban. In this ruling, the justices affirmed that the Second Amendment guarantees a right for the individual to own a gun, while at the same time noting, in the majority opinion, that like most rights, the right secured by the Second Amendment is not unlimited. And that's what Congress and the President are debating right now. What does the Second Amendment really mean? And are some limits still constitutional? Today in The Exchange, we examine these questions with two constitutional scholars as part of the New Hampshire Humanities Council's year-long Constitutionally Speaking series, examining our founding document, how we look at it today. We've been trying to do that as well on The Exchange. So let's hear from you. How do you read the Second Amendment? How far do you think its right to bear arms extends? Is it an absolute right, or are some limits constitutional? And how do you think we should, in our time, interpret particular words of the amendment, such as this right shall not be infringed, or a well-regulated militia? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. We have two guests who've been looking at this for a long time. Joining us from D.C., Professor Randy Barnett. He's a professor of constitutional law at Georgetown Law, where he directs the Center for the Constitution. He also tried many felony cases as a prosecutor in the Cook County State's Attorney's Office in Chicago. And Professor Barnett, really nice to have you. Thank you for your time.
Great to be here, Laura.
Also with us from Chicago, Professor Jeffrey Stone, law professor at the University of Chicago. He served as a law clerk at the U.S. Supreme Court. He teaches and writes about constitutional law. And Professor Stone, thank you also for your time. We understand you've got some tricky weather out there, so we appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Well, I want to start off, gentlemen, by reading the Second Amendment. There's only 27 words, so it won't take me very long. And here it is, just to lay it out there at the beginning of the program. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed. Professor Barnett, to you first, what does that language say to you about what the founders' intent was with those words chosen?
Well, we had about a 20-year debate about the meaning of those words, and it's a very technical debate that involves the use of a lot of evidence and argument and counter-argument. In the Heller case, the court adopted the view, which I think is the correct view, and that is that the Second Amendment protects a right, an individual right, to keep and also to bear arms, the same kind of right that the First Amendment protects. And it also states that the purpose or one of the purposes for the protection of that individual right was the preservation of a well-armed militia, a well-regulated militia. And the militia in those days, in fact, even today under U.S. law, the militia is composed of the body of the people who are responsible for bringing their own arms for the purposes of collective and individual self-defense. So that's basically what I think the amendment says. It's what the court has held that it says, and then we now have to decide what that entails for gun laws today.
Yes, they're debating on Capitol Hill and at the White House, and I'm glad you mentioned Heller. We'll touch on that later for sure. So it's not just, Professor Barnett, what those individual original words say. It's how the High Court has interpreted them over time. Is that what you're saying there?
Well, yes, although the High Court really didn't interpret those words for a very, very long time. There was a case in the 30s, which both sides claimed to be their own, which was it's somewhat cryptic, the Miller case. But other than the Miller case, there really hasn't been a Supreme Court case until Heller in 2008 decided what the meaning of the text was. And I think one of the reasons why they did rely on the original meaning of the words, in fact, even the dissent was asserting what the original meaning of the words were, is because the court basically had a free field to interpret, there were no previous precedents standing in the way of adopting the amendment's original meaning.
Yeah, and Professor Stone, you know, obviously we can't go back and ask the founders what they were thinking, although that would be nice. But what's your take on what they meant by this simple 27-word amendment?
Well, I think what they meant is very strongly informed by the first clause, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. They don't say the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, which would be parallel to many of the other individual rights guaranteed in the Bill of Rights. Instead, they give a clear definition of why there is a right to keep and bear arms. And until the Heller decision, the general view in American law for 200 years had been that the right was not an individual right of any person to have a gun for whatever purpose he chose, but that, in fact, the right to own a gun was because of the need of individuals to participate in a state militia. And as Professor Barnett said in the Miller case in the 1930s, the court clearly assumed that that's what the amendment meant, and indeed it's what pretty much everybody thought the amendment meant until very recently. The Heller case was a 5-4 decision. There were five justices who took one view, there were four justices who took the other. They disagreed about what it was the framers intended. My own view, unlike Randy's, is that the four justices had it right, that it does not guarantee a right of the individual to own a gun. It guarantees the right of the state to have an effective militia. And to do that, individuals have to have access to guns in a world in which the only way a militia could have existed 200 years ago was by individuals owning guns so they could serve in the militia.
Okay, so that's interesting, and I wish listeners could have the language right in front of them, because it seems like, Professor Stone, you're emphasizing the importance of the first half of the amendment, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. You say that's really important. That's definitional in your mind. Whereas other people might look at the second part of it, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It's almost like there's two different things going on there. Is that what you're saying?
No, I think there's one thing going on there. The framers were saying that because we need to serve this purpose, a right will exist in order to serve that purpose. It would be as if, say, in the First Amendment to the Constitution, the court had said in order to have a well-functioning political system, the right of the people to engage in freedom of speech shall not be infringed. And if that were the case, we would understand that the right of free speech was defined by the political system. So the right to engage in political speech would be protected, but the right to engage, say, in commercial advertising would not be protected.
So you're linking the first half and the second half together strongly.
Well, that's how they wrote them, yeah.
Yeah, what do you think?
I mean, I'm not an originalist, but if you're an originalist, then, yeah, you basically read the whole thing and make sense out of it.
What do you think about that, Professor Barnett? This is an interesting point.
Well, if you look at the statements that were made in the period around the time of the adoption of the Bill of Rights, you will find several statements that affirm the existence or the desirability of an individual right to keep and bear arms. What state constitutions at that time referred to was the right to keep and bear arms in defense of themselves. The people have the right to keep and bear arms in defense of themselves and the state, distinguishing between self-defense and the defense of the polity. This was a pretty widely shared view. It was in state constitutions. It was articulated and proposed as the precursor of the Second Amendment. There is, in fact, no one at the time of the founding who said that the right to keep and bear arms was a collective right, a right of the people to participate in a militia. There's not a single example of anyone at the founding who articulated the view that we are told everyone at the founding had when those words were written. Where the argument on the other side comes from historians and other people who take the other side of this argument is from what they call context. And they say the context of the language of the bill, of the Second Amendment is that the founders were very concerned about protecting the militia, and therefore we should read this as solely limited to the protection of an organized militia as opposed to the general militia. It is true that that context is true, that there was a lot of concern with the militia, which explains why the preface to the Second Amendment is there. But in fact, there's no examples of anyone who actually reached the conclusion that the Second Amendment or the words in the Second Amendment pertain to the kind of right that Jeff's talking about. So, it's difficult to prove these things with any degree of certainty, But if you have examples of one kind of right on one side and you have no examples of the other kind on the other side, then it starts to tell you which side might be right.
All right. And since we mentioned the language. Yeah, hold on, Professor Stone, if I could, just for a second. We talked about the language. We've put the language, again, those 27 words of the Second Amendment, on the exchanges page on our website, nhpr.org. So if you want to be looking at that while we pick apart this language and what it might mean and how we interpret it, you can go to nhpr.org and take a look at it. You can also call in at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And gentlemen, since we're talking about the history, here's an email from Kim who says, could someone talk about the history of the Second Amendment? Kim says, my understanding is that it was included because it was an assurance to the slaveholding Southern states who required their men to participate in state militias, the purpose of which was to help round up runaway slaves and keep down slave revolts. Kim says that explains the militia language. She says the Second Amendment was crucial to the passage of the Constitution to get the Southern states, and they used this amendment to do so. Kim, thank you for the email. And Professor Stone, what do you think?
To be honest, I'd never heard that theory before. It's an interesting theory. It might make sense, but I just can't comment on it. I don't know if Randy is familiar with it.
Yeah, I've heard that theory many times, and it's not surprising that your listeners would be aware of it. It is true that some of the deep Southern states were, you know, pretty pro-slavery, and things were in the Constitution they liked because of that. But in fact, the predominant view amongst the people who wrote the Constitution was anti-slavery. There was an assumption that slavery was unjust, in conflict with the Declaration of Independence, and was on the road to extinction. It really wasn't until the invention of the cotton gin that there became an affirmatively pro-slavery ideology. The militia was something that everyone in the United States believed in. And the militia served a variety of purposes. In the Deep South, it may have served that purpose, but in the North and in the Middle states, it served the purpose of community, individual and community self-defense. So,
okay. And Professor Stone, Professor Byrne, hold on one sec.
There's nothing in the debates over this particular. And one other thing I will say that.
Actually, we're heading into a break, Professor Barnett. Sure. I so apologize. And I know Professor Stone wanted to jump in earlier, too. So we're going to take a quick break for a minute. When we come back, both of your comments. And also, we'll hear from our listeners at 1-800-892-6477.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and more on Constitutionally Speaking about the Second Amendment on the Exchange. At 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, it's the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup. NHPR brings you the news every day, all year long. News from around the world, across the country, and throughout the state. Breaking news, developing stories, weather and sports. NHPR, keeping New Hampshire connected. New Hampshire weather today, lots of sunshine, highs in the 30s, clouding up tonight, lows tonight in the teens. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Gibson's Bookstore in Concord, welcoming science fiction author, activist, and journalist Cory Doctorow on Sunday, February 24th at 3 p.m., discussing his new book, Homeland. And from Bedford Falls, a benchmark senior living community with a team of dedicated caregivers working together with families to improve the quality of aging. Bedford Falls Assisted Living and .com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, constitutionally speaking about what the Second Amendment means, how we interpret it today. By the way, if you want to look at the Second Amendment language as we examine it, you can go to the Exchange page at nhpr.org. We've got the 27 words up there. We invite you to join us with your questions and comments, too, at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. What's your take on some of the words and phrases in this amendment, such as we've talked about, a well-regulated militia, or to keep and bear arms, or shall not be infringed? For example, how do you define infringed? Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And Professor Stone, Professor Barnett, lots to dig into. We've got lots of listeners who want to join us too. But Professor Barnett, I want to let you finish up your point before the break. And Professor Stone, I know you had a point earlier that you didn't get a chance to make. So Professor Barnett, go ahead and wrap up there, please.
Yeah, I'm sorry it took so long to get that out. All I want to say is that the amendments weren't enacted until 2 years after the Constitution was ratified. by 11 of the 13 states. So it just can't have been the case that the amendment was offered as a means of inducing southern states to get into the union, which they'd already joined before the amendment was even put before them.
Talking about Kim's email again. And Professor Stone, earlier you had wanted to make a point as well. Go ahead.
Well, I was basically going to make two points that related and simple. I mean, the first is that when we try to figure out what the, quote, framers intended with respect to most parts of the Constitution, when they are broadly written and defined as this is, rather than say you have to be 35 years old to be president,
yeah.
The truth is that there's rarely going to be simple and obvious consensus because the language is often unclear. The framers didn't focus on the question about precisely what it meant. But here you have a text, and the text actually is pretty clear. And if you give this text to most people who have no particular pre-existing interest in arguing for or against gun control, they will interpret it as saying, well, yeah, this means that, that this is about protecting the militia. And that may, that's why it was written the way it was, and we don't need to go beyond that. It clearly means on its face what it says it means. And the second point I make is that there's not a simple answer here. I mean, the truth is that the Supreme Court justices divided 5-4 on this. Scholars have divided on this and disagreed about it. Historians, I think, are very much on one side of this equation, that is to take the view of the four dissenters in Heller. But the truth is we could talk about this forever. We could look at the words forever. And we're not going to get much further than we are now.
Wow.
Which is to say that there's mixed evidence, it cuts both ways, there's not a right or wrong answer.
And again, when you talk about Heller, and I mentioned it earlier in the hour as well, that's the 2008 decision, right, Professor Stone, that established an individual right to bear arms, sort of not necessarily connected to the militia. As I suspected, gentlemen, lots of calls. Let's go to them now. Again, the number for you to join us with your thoughts, questions, your own interpretations of what the Second Amendment means is 1-800-892-6477. Let's go first to Nashua. Kevin's on the air. Hi, Kevin. Go ahead.
Hey, Laura. How are you today?
Good. Thanks.
Good. I'll be brief. I try to take an objective look when it comes to arguments like we're having here today. The one thing that I want to mention, though, as far as the specific argument saying that when the Constitution was written, only certain arms were available, at the time the Constitution was written, slavery was commonplace, and women didn't have the right to vote. Times have changed, but the principles written in the Constitution, I believe, have stayed the same. All men are created equal, the right to bear arms. It's just not an argument that I think holds much water.
What do you think, Kevin, if I could ask you a question? Do you mind?
No, go ahead.
Yeah, so what do you think about this right to bear arms shall not be infringed? Is that an absolute right? Would some limits to that right still meet constitutional muster in your mind, Kevin? What do you think?
Well, again, I think that the principles of the Constitution are consistent. Obviously, times changing call for certain actions to be taken, but as far as saying that all rights should not be infringed, I think the right depends on the individual. If it's a law-abiding individual, I think that their rights should not be infringed. But as the arguments have been stating, if the individual is not of sound mind or has a violent history, then they are no longer entitled to such rights.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling, Kevin. And Professor Barnett, to you first, this word infringe, what does shall not infringe mean? How do you interpret that?
Well, it means shall not be violated, shall not be restricted. Let me just start with a point that I know that Jeff and I are going to agree about, and that is that all liberty may be regulated. I'm a contracts professor as well. Contract law regulates the making of contracts. If you want to enter into a will, the making of wills is regulated. You have to have it in a certain form. There has to be a certain number of witnesses for that will to be operative. All liberty may be regulated. I think what I would start with that as a point of agreement. And then I think the second point we both agree with as well, and that is if you have a constitutionally protected liberty, unfortunately, courts generally do not scrutinize regulation of liberty all that carefully unless it's a constitutionally protected liberty or what's called a fundamental right. And when it is, then they are a lot more strict in how they evaluate regulations of liberty to make sure that they're not really aimed at discouraging the exercise of the right and restricting the exercise of the right. And I think we would both agree about that. And then the only question at that point becomes How is the right to keep and bear arms going to be scrutinized now that it's been recognized to be a fundamental right by a majority of the court?
An individual right, again, under this Heller case that we keep coming back to. So I want to get to Professor Stone, but Professor Barnett, in this example that Kevin gives and that you give, all liberty may be regulated. How do you regulate this right to bear arms without infringing on the right to bear arms?
Well, that is, Laura, that involves knowing a lot about firearms and knowing a lot about how gun laws work. You can't answer those questions in the abstract. You have to ask about particular measures and the effects of particular laws before you can answer the question of whether it is in fact a reasonable and permissible regulation of a liberty, or whether in fact it's unduly burdens the exercise of that liberty, or is in fact aimed at demonizing or stigmatizing and raising the cost of exercising that liberty because some folks don't like it. And the only way to answer that question, you cannot be answered in the abstract. It has to be answered in the particular.
Can you give a quick example of what might fall under an infringement or what might fall under an acceptable regulation of liberty, as you put it?
Yeah, I mean, just as an example, because it's obviously very, very commonly discussed, the so-called assault weapons ban is aimed at weapons defined by statute that are functionally indistinguishable from weapons that are continued to allow to be legal. In fact, they're just weapons that appear to look like military weapons but don't operate like military weapons. That law doesn't, it restricts the use of particular kinds of weapons, but it doesn't have any public safety effects. In fact, when we had an assault weapons ban, it didn't have any effect on public safety in the past, which is one reason it was allowed to lapse. So something like that, if you actually, you have to look at what the law actually bans, you have to see how it compares with weapons that it doesn't ban, you have to see what the effects of that law is likely to be, and then you'll realize at that point that that's an undue restriction on the exercise of a liberty.
Yeah, Professor Stone, love to hear from you too on this. Kevin's point about infringement and Professor Barnett's point about all liberty may be regulated, but you have to make sure that that regulation doesn't infringe, to go back to the Second Amendment's words. What do you think, Professor Stone, your thoughts?
Okay, so first of all, let's get to that point. Let's just assume that the first half of the Second Amendment was never there.
The militia part.
So all it said is, the Second Amendment says, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That's the way the majority of the Supreme Court chose to interpret the Second Amendment. It just erases the first half. So let's assume that's what the Second Amendment said. And then the question is, okay, what does that mean? Okay, and the focus should be not on the word infringed, but on the word right. Right. So what we know is the right shall not be infringed. But the question is, what is the right that shall not be infringed? So a good example of this, which takes it out of the Second Amendment context, is the First Amendment. So the First Amendment provides that the government shall not may not make any law abridging the freedom of speech. Right. And the question is, what does that mean? Now, it could mean the government cannot regulate any speech at all in any circumstance. It shall not abridge the freedom of speech. But as Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes noted in an example meant to make exactly this point, it can't mean that. It can't mean, for example, that the government can't punish someone for falsely yelling fire in a crowded theater. That's where that hypothetical comes from. It proved that it doesn't mean literally what it says. So the question is, what is the right, say in the free speech context, that may not be abridged? And there are lots of things that we conclude are not part of the right. So, for example, there's no right to sell child pornography under the First Amendment. There's no right to sell obscenity under the First Amendment. There's no right to engage in defamation of people under the First Amendment. I don't have a right to use a loudspeaker at midnight in a residential neighborhood as part of the freedom of speech. I don't have the right to go into the White House to yell at the president because I disagree with his policies, and on and on and on. So the reality is, we have to define what is the right that may not be abridged, or in the Second Amendment context, what is the right that may not be infringed. And that does require a degree of interpretation as to what is the point of having this right in the first place. And just as we accept all these many limitations on the First Amendment right, as much as we cherish freedom of speech, we recognize that the examples I gave are not part of that freedom of speech. And the same is true with respect to the Second Amendment. So even if one treated the Second Amendment as if it said what it doesn't say, you still would have the problem of asking, okay, what are the contours of that right? And that's a difficult question, just as it is in the First Amendment context. But I would say that, as the Supreme Court recognized in Heller, that reasonable regulations of the desire of individuals to own guns are permissible as long as the core right remains in place.
The core right.
And so, unlike Professor Barnett, I would disagree, for example, on the assault weapons ban. It seems to me that the right to keep and bear arms does not include the right to own military weapons. It doesn't include the right to own a tank. It doesn't include the right to own a nuclear weapon. It doesn't include the right to own a bazooka. Whatever purpose it serves, once you limit its text to the last half of the amendment, it presumably means the right to protect oneself in a reasonable way from harm, either on the street or in one's home.
So agreeing
and
with Professor
reasonable is the key word there.
Agreeing with Professor Barnett, then, that all liberty may be regulated, the disagreement comes, and this is why we have court cases, in terms of what is a reasonable limit and what it really constitutes infringement, Professor Stone, if I got you right there. Okay, let's go back to our listeners. And again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. How do you read the Second Amendment today? How do you interpret it? What do you make of some of the particular phrases that we're examining this hour? Our number is 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, let's go back to the phones. And Carrie's joining us from Jaffrey. Hi, Carrie. Thanks for hanging on. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I am driving, and I am unfortunately headed right into a coverage hole. Hold on a second. All right, my point was that the picture that people have of the Second Amendment in revolutionary time was that everybody had a gun in their house and everybody had it hung on the wall. But I remember listening to a previous guest saying that in those times, even though most people couldn't afford a gun, it was very hard to afford the powder and the bullets, so that those were kept in the community storehouse, which would mean that keeping your private gun would be more like aimed at being part of a militia, and it was not so much an individual right, but as an individual responsibility, which this made possible.
So, Carrie, what's your point then? You see this more as a militia right and not so much about the individual? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and that when you take this picture of what they think the revolutionary period when this was written looked like, they are going toward the individual rights and not focusing on the original purpose, which was to make sure that there was a militia of people who knew how to use the gun and when the community called could go get the bullets and the powder and then defend the community.
Okay. Carrie, thanks a lot for calling in. And gentlemen, we touched on this earlier, but Professor Barnett, talk about, again, we keep getting back to this 2008 Supreme Court case, the Heller decision. How did Heller respond to that militia argument?
Well, the first thing, I just wanted to say I agreed with pretty much everything that Jeff Stone said before about the First Amendment. So mm-hmm. I just wanted to note a point of agreement there. With respect to what this caller said about what things were like at the founding, I just need to caution people who may have heard various press coverage on this issue in the past. There was a very, very prominent book about firearms in America, written by a historian named Michael Belial. It was given the Bancroft Prize in History by Columbia University. It turned out, and it made exactly the claim that caller remembers someone making that she heard on the radio. It turns out that the evidence that firearms possession was scarce at the founding was fraudulent in this book. In fact, the Bancroft Committee withdrew the prize from the book, and Mr. Belial lost his job at Emory Law School because of the fraudulent nature of the scholarship that he produced. So I can understand why people might believe this. It got a lot of publicity at the time. But in fact, it turns out that particular work was fraudulent in very important respects.
Well, and thanks for that call, Carrie. And here's an email I want to share with you, and I think I'll turn to you, Professor Stone. This is from Barbara in Epsom. She says, we keep going back to history here. In the 18th century, our perceived enemies were Native Americans, the French, Spanish, and English, which were on this continent. The weapons referred to in the Constitution were muzzle loaders. Today, we are far less rural populations. The weapons used in the Newtown Massacre mow people down. They kill dozens in minutes. Please consider this, Barbara says. Can you put that thought for us, please, Professor Stone, into this conversation about the Second Amendment?
Well, I mean, I think that point is exactly right, that on both counts. I mean, both there was a specific rationale and need for a gun ownership at the time, which is very different from the case today, and the nature of the guns at the time were very different in terms of the capacity to do harm, and therefore the need for regulation is much greater. Let me make another point about the nature of the right from a quite different perspective.
Sure.
Almost every right in our Bill of Rights has been adopted in constitutions around the world, whether it's freedom of speech or freedom of religion, or freedom from cruel and unusual punishment, or freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures. Almost all constitutions everywhere in the world, 185 constitutions adopted in, say, the last 60 years, have adopted the vast majority of those. Only two of those 185 have adopted a right to keep and bear arms. And the reason for that is not so much about guns as such. It's that everyone has understood that it may have made sense to give people a right to keep and bear arms at a time when you needed a militia. And you didn't have, for example, police forces. But in a world in which you have National Guards and police forces, the concept of a right to keep and bear arms as a constitutional right really doesn't make any sense at all. And the reason I offer that is not so much to say that, therefore, they're right and we're wrong in our views today, but that gives a lot of perspective about what the meaning of the right really was. It's a right about militia. That's what the framers thought. It's not a right about individuals walking around with guns on their belt because they feel cool or they feel powerful. And the need for the militia is obsolete. It's been gone for 100, 200 years. And that's why no other country in the world except for two has replicated this right.
Although,
and
Professor Stone,
that gives good content to what this right is about.
Yeah, and yet, we keep getting back to this, did that 2008 Heller decision by the Supreme Court establish an individual right? It kind of set aside the militia argument that you're making. Is that right?
Yes, it did. They read the Second Amendment as if the first half of the amendment didn't exist. They just took out an eraser and they erased it because they didn't like it.
Yeah.
Laura, maybe I should respond.
Go ahead, Professor Barnett. Yeah.
They didn't purport to do that. They said that the first part of the Second Amendment explained the purpose of the right, just like the preface of the Constitution explains the purpose of what follows. And in fact, the protection of an individual right was a means of achieving that purpose. And so they didn't ignore it. You may not agree with what they did do about it, but they didn't ignore it. They didn't erase it. They did pay close attention to it. And the other thing I would just remind, it's difficult to resolve these historical matters on the radio. It's difficult enough to resolve them in print. But I will just say there isn't a single person at the time of the founding who articulated the view of the Second Amendment that we are told everyone at the founding had. It wasn't until the 1830s in some state constitutional cases that you first hear this militia-centric, militia-conditioned expression of a right. It would not say it's not possible. It's just that there's no examples of anyone who actually held that view of the Second Amendment that anybody has discovered so far.
Well, Barbara, thanks for the email. Lots of conversation coming out of that. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Phone calls are great. 1-800-892-6477. If you're on the line, stay there. We'll be right back.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children every day, nhsaa.org. And the Music Hall of Portsmouth, presenting classical violinist Joshua Bell in concert with guest British pianist Sam Haywood, Friday, March 1st at 8 p.m. Tickets at themusichall.org. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
NHPR counts on listener support to keep you informed about important issues and events in New Hampshire and around the world. We always try to keep fundraising to a minimum, and when you give online before the drive, you can help us out with that. Plus, you'll be automatically entered to win all of our drawing prizes throughout the March Fund Drive, and when you make your gift before 6 p.m. on February 28th, you could win an Apple iPad. Make your gift at nhpr.org or call 1-888-805-NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, constitutionally speaking about the Second Amendment, we've been talking about what the founders may have meant, how we interpret these 27 words today. If you want to look at those words, by the way, we've got the Second Amendment up on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. So go ahead and take a look at it as we have our conversation and give us your thoughts. How do you read the Second Amendment? How far do you think its right to bear arms extends? Is it an absolute right? Are some limits constitutional? We'd also like your thoughts on some of the words and phrases that we've been talking about in this amendment. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. And Professor Heller, Professor Stone, Professor Barnett and Professor Stone, we've talked so much about the Heller case. That's why that came up. Let's go next to Bristol. And Joshua's on the air. Go ahead, Joshua.
Hi there. Thanks for having my call.
Sure.
My question is for either person to answer. In light of the things that are going on in Syria and all over the world, let's say that for the interest of public safety, we relinquish the right as for an individual to keep and bear arms. In light of the fact of the Citizens United case and corporations have as much right to vote as me, if a government over time became less representative and you had relinquished your right to keep and bear arms, this is all theoretical, but, you know, 200-300 years from now, if you relinquish your right, wouldn't you think it would be a lot harder to get it back, especially from a government that may or may not represent the majority, we call the 99%, and maybe they represent the upper stratosphere of the citizenry, you know, the 1%. Now, how hard would you think it would be to get that back? Thank you.
Joshua, thank you very much. Professor Stone, what do you think?
I don't think the question is one of relinquishing the right. The question is, what is the right? And the argument that's made is we should have a right that because we think that this is a problem that we might want to face in the future. But the truth is, if that was the concern, then the kind of arms that people are going to be allowed to have under the Second Amendment are not going to be terribly helpful if the government is deciding that it wants to suppress the people. Unless you allow people to have tanks and nuclear weapons, bazookas and airplanes in their private possession, in the modern world, owning a handgun, for example, or even a rifle or even an assault rifle is not going to realistically be able to defend yourself against the overbearing government. So the practical reality is that the Second Amendment, even as robustly enforced as the majority of the justices of the Supreme Court recognized, would not really be responsive to that concern.
Even if you had a high-powered gun, you would be no match against tanks.
Yeah, realistically, you know, against the United States government, if it was tending to get you and to suppress you, you know, as we've seen that with drones and everything else, I mean, these weapons are of very little value against an oppressive government.
You know, I got an email here from Brian that kind of picks up on what you say, Joshua, so thank you. Brian says, do the people have the right to turn against its own government in extreme cases? Couldn't we interpret the right of the people to keep and bear arms to have some link to Thomas Jefferson's quote, that the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants? Brian goes on to say, as an example, in the late 19th and early 20th century, citizens found it necessary to defend themselves with arms against their government when governors of various states, at the behest of business owners, sent troops out to violently suppress labor strikes. So that's kind of picking up on what Joshua said. Professor Barnett, your thoughts quickly, too.
Well, the reason why the militia was thought to be essential, and this is a militia composed of the body of the people that have their own arms, is in part to protect a country from tyranny. And in fact, I'm not sure I agree with Jeff about this. Privately armed civilians have, in fact, been able to resist oppressive governments with organized militaries throughout the world. It's not always pretty and it's not always successful, but it does raise the cost of tyranny, and that's something that provides a deterrent effect to governments from becoming too oppressive to their people.
Well, and our emailer, Brian, mentions state governors and people in states being suppressed when they tried to strike against labor. I want to ask both of you, and you first, Professor Stone, how the U.S. Constitution's Second Amendment lines up with gun rights established by state constitutions. Do they line up pretty well, or do we sometimes see some conflicting interpretations there?
Actually, I'm going to defer to Randy on that, because the truth is I don't know enough about the state constitutional provisions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Professor Barnett.
Well, some state constitutional provisions are written far more clearly to protect an individual right to arms that brook no disagreement about the fact that that's what they were for. And state courts have interpreted them in a variety of ways. And generally speaking, state courts have interpreted these provisions rather permissively, meaning they do permit a considerable amount of regulation, even beyond which I think is proper. But generally speaking, that has been the attitude of state courts, not to deprive the right entirely, but to be very permissive in what laws may be passed.
All right, Brian, thanks for the email. Again, the email address is exchange@nhpr.org. The number 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Gentlemen, earlier we talked about some of the current proposals being debated in Washington and whether they constitute an infringement or not. We talked about controls on certain types of weaponry. I want to ask you about another item that's being debated and whether you think that fits under the Second Amendment or not. And this is, Professor Stone, universal background checks. Some people are calling for this, no matter what kind of sale of what kind of weapon, gun shows, individual to individual. Some are calling for universal background checks. How does that square, Professor Stone, do you think, with the Second Amendment?
Well, the court in Heller, even though recognizing an individual right, also recognized that the government could regulate the right in reasonable ways, just as it can free speech. The rights are different, and so the appropriate regulations would be different. I think that the idea of a universal background check to own a gun is perfectly consistent with the individual right. It basically says you have a right to own a gun, but there are circumstances, as the court itself acknowledged in Heller, in which individuals should not be allowed to own a gun, and the state can prohibit certain people from owning a gun. And the best way to deal with that is to go through a universal background check. So I don't think that's controversial. I think the Supreme Court would uphold that 9-0.
That doesn't infringe based on what the court has said, both in the 2008 Heller decision. What about, just real quickly, Professor Stone, the 2010 McDonald decision against Chicago's gun restrictions? Did the justices in that decision also say, look, we're striking down these particular restrictions, but that doesn't mean other restrictions might not be upheld?
Right. Now, the critical issue in McDonald was whether the right guaranteed in the Second Amendment, which at the time it was enacted, was a right against the federal government. It's not a right to keep and bear arms. It's a right not to have the federal government interfere with your right to keep and bear arms. And so the question in McDonald was whether that same right also limits the states. And the history of that is that when the nation adopted the 14th Amendment after the Civil War, which did limit the powers of the states to restrict a wide variety of rights, the question over time is, well, does that mean the states also cannot abridge freedom of religion? Does it mean the states can also not abridge freedom of speech? Does it mean the states also cannot engage in unreasonable searches and seizures? And over time, the Supreme Court has basically held that the rights guaranteed in the Bill of Rights apply to the states in the same way they apply to the federal government through the 14th Amendment. The question in McDonald was whether the Second Amendment also applies to the states. And there, I agree with the majority that held that the Second Amendment does apply to the states, and that the state of Illinois or the city of Chicago are limited by the Second Amendment in the same way that the federal government is.
Yeah.
And so to that extent, it expanded enormously the constitutional right from just the federal government to the states. But I think that extension was completely correct, given the way the court has treated this issue with respect to other rights.
And in terms of universal background checks, to you, Professor Barnett, as well, does that come under the word infringe or not?
Let me just say that I agree with what Jeff said about the incorporation of the Second Amendment against the states. I just will add that the evidence surrounding the meaning of the right to keep and bear arms at the time of the 14th Amendment is overwhelmingly individualistic. It was meant to put arms or keep arms in the hands of freed blacks and Republicans in the South who were being victimized by mob violence and militia violence. The militias were the bad guys in that story. So I totally agree with him about that. With respect to universal background checks, again, I just want to go back to the general principle, and that is that if you have a constitutionally protected fundamental right, you are not allowed to restrict the exercise of that right just because somebody has an idea that sounds good, or that the legislature thinks it might have an effect. You actually have to show that it does have an effect in protecting public safety, for example. It actually has to have an effect if it's going to raise the cost of exercising the right. And in the case of background checks, we have an extensive background check system already in place. It applies even, for example, at gun shows, where any commercial seller has to run background checks before they can sell a gun. The only thing that that these universal background check laws are aimed at are the sales by one person to another. So, for example, if you want to sell a gun that you have to a friend of yours or any particular individual, you as an individual citizen are going to have to run a background check on the person that you want to sell the gun to, or perhaps even give the gun to a friend or give the gun to a relative. The question you have to ask in evaluating the constitutionality of that is, what harm is it aimed at? Is there any evidence that there is a problem that's caused by those kinds of sales? And will this stop it? In other words, will this actually affect that misbehavior by people who are willing to break the law, which, of course, is the problem with all of these gun laws, and that is it only assumes people will obey the laws that are made. And that's the question you have to ask with respect to any of these proposals. Not does it sound good, but actually does it really affect a problem that really exists?
And just real quickly, Professor Barnett, both you and Professor Stone mentioned the 14th Amendment and touched on how it is present in this discussion over the Second Amendment. Just remind us, though, real quick, Professor Barnett, what the 14th Amendment says, how it affects the debate over guns.
Well, it says no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, or the equal protection of the laws. That's the first sentence actually gives citizenship to everyone who's naturally born, who's born in the United States. So that's what Section 1 of the 14th Amendment says. And even though it is absolutely overwhelming evidence that the individual right to keep and bear arms was thought to be among the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, that clause has been rendered non-operative by the Supreme Court, and the right to keep and bear arms was instead protected in the McDonald case by the Due Process Clause, which says that no person shall be deprived of life or liberty without due process of law, under, as Jeff explains, the standard way that this court has applied the Bill of Rights to the states.
Okay, just a couple minutes left, gentlemen, so let's take one more call, and Jeff is in Warner. Hi, Jeff, you're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, too.
Sure.
My comment is that, you know, the Constitution and the Bill of Rights extends to the people the right to peacefully assemble and, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of press. So I just want to comment that I just don't find it credible when I hear people say that the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed means the militia. It means the people.
Because of that word choice, Jeff, the people.
No, because the First and Fourth Amendment extends to the people the right to assemble and the right of freedom of the press and the right of freedom of speech to the people, individual people. And then other people today are telling me that, you know, the Second Amendment doesn't mean the people when it says the people.
I see what you're saying. Okay. You're saying the other amendments talk about the people, so it's the same with the second.
Yeah, it's pretty elementary, and I just don't find the argument that it means a state militia to be credible at all.
Okay, thanks for the call. And Jeff Stone, this was your argument. You've been questioning that individual versus militia. So go ahead on that, please.
Well, I would just really repeat what I said before, is that in deciding what a particular right means, you have to look at the text. And unlike the other amendments, the Second Amendment gives a very specific statement about why it exists. And you can't just ignore that. Now, Randy says the court took that into account in interpreting the amendment. I don't think they took it into account in a responsible way. I think they chose essentially to disregard it. But basically, the difference is you have to look at the full text of any provision to understand what it means. And what the caller basically wants to say is the first 13 words of the amendment aren't there, and that therefore this right is the same as other rights which don't have a qualifying clause. Whatever one thinks the qualifying clause means, you can't just ignore it. You have to take it seriously and figure out, in the same way that you would in the example I gave before, the First Amendment, it says that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of political speech. We wouldn't say it therefore protects commercial advertising. The text matters.
Just to wrap up with both of you. Yeah. Oh, well, Professor Barnett, go ahead.
Yeah, if I may. I mean, I think the caller makes a very good point. The Second Amendment itself distinguishes between the body of the people known as the militia and the body of the people known as the people. It doesn't say the right of the militia to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Secondly, the Tenth Amendment distinguishes between the people and the states. It says the power not delegated by the Constitution to the United States are reserved to the states respectively or to the people, distinguishing between the body known as states, or like state militias, or the body known as the people. So I think the caller is exactly right on textualist grounds.
Well, and just looking ahead, I'll turn to you first, Professor Barnett. You know, you've thought a lot about the Second Amendment, written a lot about it. What are you going to be especially listening for, Professor Barnett, as these debates over gun control proposals unfold on Capitol Hill?
I'm going to be listening for evidence that there is a statement for the actual problem that any particular law is supposed to be addressing, and evidence that the particular measure that's being proposed will have an effect on that problem. Not just does this sound like a good idea, especially to people who don't know that much about firearms and don't know that much about how laws affect firearm ownership. For example, people who don't know that so-called assault weapons fire at the same rate of speed and have the same or actually less lethality than hunting rifles. If people don't even know that basic fact, then they're not a reliable source of what a reasonable regulation of that right is.
Jeffrey Stone, what are you going to be looking for and listening for as these conversations unfold on Capitol Hill and at the White House?
Well, I mean, I think looking for is basically the politics of the situation. I mean, what you've got here are groups in society that feel very strongly about this issue from deeply divergent perspectives. And that makes it very difficult to do any kind of a reasonable compromise in the realm of politics. So I think what I'm looking for on this political question is, I don't think really there's a serious constitutional question about any of the regulations that have been proposed. That it's really a political question is, to what extent, within the confines of the Second Amendment, will the government in fact enact regulations that treat guns, for example, you know, you have to have background check to sell a car. I don't see any good constitutional reason why you can't have a background check to sell a gun.
All right.
I can't sell you my car without going through a formal process. I don't see any reason why I should be able to sell you a gun the same way.
Well, gentlemen, I feel like I've been sitting in on a really great constitutional law class. I really want to thank both of you for your time. Professor Stone, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Laura, for having me. It was fun.
Professor Jeffrey Stone, law professor at the University of Chicago, also served as a law clerk at the U.S. Supreme Court. Professor Barnett, good to have you, too. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you, Laura.
Professor Randy Barnett, professor of constitutional law at Georgetown, where he directs the Center for the Constitution. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our intern is Faith Meixel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, we begin with former Shell Oil President John Hoffmeister, now head of a group called Citizens for Affordable Energy. Then, in his State of the Union address, President Obama called for a higher minimum wage. We'll see how that debate's playing in the Granite State. And on Friday, we talk with New Hampshire Governor Maggie Hassan as she makes the case for her new budget. Email us at nhpr.org and join us all next week for The Exchange, every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show on the Friday News Roundup next at 10 o'clock on NHPR. New Hampshire Weather, National Weather.